The views and opinions expressed by individuals on the following program do not necessarily reflect those of the network, Guys Guy Radio, and its platforms.
It's Guys Guy Radio. Here's your host, Robert Manning.
Welcome to Guys Guys Radio. This is your host, Robert Manny, welcoming you to the show where men and women can be at their best and everyone wins, Guys Guys Radio. We're here to inform you, inspire you, empower you, and get you to think, feel, and who knows, maybe even act by virtue of the journeys, stories, experiences, and insights of the guests I bring you each and every week to the show. And again, this week is no exception. Today, we're going to talk about the Beatles. But we're going to talk about the Beatles in a special way because, you know, it's decades since the Beatles have been together as a group, way back in the 1970s. Yet their influence keeps going on and on. And I think as time transpires over the years and the decades into the future, people are going to still be listening to Beatles music because of a number of reasons. One, they were super talented and they played together very well, and the sum of their parts is incredible. When you listen to their solo recordings, there's some good music there, but together they're just pretty much untouchable in terms of songwriting and harmonies, and they went through a number of different periods in their evolution. But we're going to talk about the Beatles with my special guest, the return guest to Guys Guys Radio, Joanne DiMaggio. And Joanne's been pursuing past life research, therapy, and soul writing for the past 3.5 decades. And Joanne has put together a number of books. And this one is about the Beatles. And it's called The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Joanne also had the responsibility of running a Beatles fan club way back in the 60s, and it was quite an experience. Joanne was in Chicago, and the club ran from there. It wasn't the worldwide fan club, but Joanne had her fan club and had to really integrate that into the overall system. So part of the book is about the experience of running a fan club, but the bulk of the book, the core of the book, and the foundation of the book is really about the Beatles, their music, and how they tapped into the seeds of spirituality that still impact us today with a number of their songs and a lot of their music and a lot of their experiences, including, remember, they went to see the Maharishi in India and they spent some time there and people were outraged saying, what the heck? Who is the Maharishi and what are the Beatles doing there? But the Beatles were going through a period and they became very prolific from the experiences they had in India, and also taking part in transcendental meditation. I'm a little biased here because I recently, well, let's put it this way. I've been a meditator for a number of years, and I found over time I felt like it was becoming work, and I was networked into being trained for transcendental meditation, and I've been doing it every day, twice a day, 20 minutes a day for the past 2.5 months, and it's been really transformative for me. So I'm a big fan of TM right now. I'm not saying it's for everybody. Once we're in a one size doesn't fit all world, so you have to, you know, choose what you want. But the Beatles went through their TM experience, and Ringo, who was really not a spiritual one, the spiritual one, if you will, because everybody recognizes George Harrison as kind of the quiet and the spiritual Beatle, because he convinced the band to go to India and sit and meet with the Maharishi, and John got into it also, and Paul's a little more focused on the work itself. He was prolific and still is a prolific songwriter and really loves to work in a studio and really focus on the music, whereas George and John were a little bit more on the spiritual side, quote-unquote, back then. But Ringo still performs transcendental meditation all the time. I was looking at the David Lynch Organization website, and it has a number of celebrities who participate in TM, and Ringo's one of them. So amazing stuff. So we're going to have a great conversation about the Beatles. We're going to talk about the different time frames of the Beatles and the different types of music that they introduced us to and played and really excelled at. We're going to talk about the Beatles fan club with Joanne DiMaggio and her experience with that. And we're going to talk about how the Beatles may have planted the seeds of spirituality with the generations that have come since then. So it's going to be a great show on Guys Guys Radio. Thanks for being here, and we're going to get into it right away.
UK House Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome to Guys Guys Radio, the interview portion of our show. Today, we're going to talk all about the Beatles. My special guest is a return guest to Guys Guys Radio, Joanne DiMaggio. She's written 6 books. She is an expert on soul writing and past life regression. Her book, Soul Writing: Conversations with Your Higher Self, Your Soul Remembers, Accessing Your Past Lives Through Soul Writing, Karma Can Be a Real Pain, Past Life Clues, and Current Life Maladies. I Did It to Myself, again, New Life Between Lives Case Studies, and also a book, Edgar Cayce and the Unfulfilled Destiny of Thomas Jefferson Reborn, which we talked about last year. Today, we're going to talk about Joanne's new book. It's all about the Beatles and spirituality. It's called The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. Welcome back to Guys Guys Radio, Joanne DiMaggio. How are you, Joanne?
I'm doing great. Thanks for the invitation. Love being on your show.
Our pleasure. And it's always enlightening. So speaking of enlightening, you have this book about the Beatles. But let's first get into, for those who are not familiar with your work, what do you do? You have an extensive background in past life therapy, and you call yourself a reporter for the universe. And also you are an expert in soul writing. Give us an overview for everybody out there as to your work.
Well, I've been doing past life research and therapy for over 35 years. So I do regression work, take people back to the past life that's most impacting them now. And I do it with people all over the world because I do it on Zoom. And I also teach soul writing, which is a written form of meditation. So I offer that as well. And I do a lot of research projects. That's my favorite thing to do. And all of my books that you mentioned have come out of those research projects with volunteer people coming in for regressions and things like that. That's been my passion for over 35 years.
So is there a difference between soul writing and automatic writing?
Oh, big, big difference. Okay. Big difference, yeah. I'm a student of Edgar Cayce, so for your listeners to know about Mr. Casey's work. I did my master's, my thesis on soul writing, which I renamed, he called it inspirational writing. And he warned about automatic writing. A lot of people know that term, so they just use it sort of, a little bit too liberally for me. There is a difference. One of the things that they found with automatic writing is that people don't take the precautions when they're working with spirit. They don't say prayer protection, surround themselves with white light. And so they sort of, allow themselves to be open to some lower level energies that kind of get in there. And they've had a lot of reports of possession coming through with people doing automatic writing. So I have a handout that I am happy to send anybody that requests it that lists the difference between the two. And it also lists all the ways you can use soul writing and then how to actually do it. So I do want to educate people about the difference between the two of them. And it's mostly that aspect of it that you could really get yourself into some trouble with automatic writing only because you're not using the type of precautions that you need when you work with spirit.
Now, you need the grounding and the protection for automatic writing. What do you need for soul writing? How does that process work, soul writing?
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, with soul writing, you do say, you go into a meditation, you say a prayer of protection, you surround yourself with white light. So it's like picture yourself in a bubble of light so that nothing can penetrate it. People who do automatic writing skip that step. They usually just sit down with the pencil and they start writing. with soul writing, your handwriting is pretty much the same as when you write in a conscious state. With automatic writing, it's often very different, but kind of like really tiny or can go up at an angle or something like that. One of the biggest, well, what I found one of the differences too is with soul writing, you're getting a message from the collective consciousness. So it's like, we are with you always in love and in light. With automatic writing, it's usually an ego-based I am here and I'm telling you what to do. With automatic writing, people get orders, like marching orders, do this, do that, do exactly as I say. With soul writing, you're just getting a real gentle little nudge from spirit, you know, about what would be the best course of action for you. So like I said, there's a whole list of differences between the two that I'm happy to share with people. But that's primarily it. One guides you, one directs you, you know.
Okay.
And that's basically it, you know.
Now, you're also an expert in past life regression, and you've worked on yourself. I find that fascinating because as a certified hypnotist, I've sat through with classes. I've seen people hypnotize and go through past life regressions. I've gone through them. I've given them to other people. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you did it for yourself.
Well, I was fascinated with the whole idea about reincarnation since I was an adolescent. And then as I started putting pieces together of a possible past life, and became involved with the Edgar Cayce's Association for Research and Enlightenment, being in that circle, I met a lot of other past life therapists. And so I had friends who were in doing that work. And I also, because ARE would bring in past life authorities, people who had written books about it, or, mm-hmm. you know, this is from, you know, Brian Weiss to many others. I had a past life organization of my own, and I would invite them to come and do a talk for us. And then we became friends. And so I would be getting regressions from these people, from these folks, and did so for many, many years, because I believe to be a really good past life therapist, you need to go through that yourself. You need to understand not only the process, but all the different things that could come up so that you're prepared to help people through, especially if it's a highly charged, emotionally, you know, filled lifetime. But mostly, you know, well, what do you do with this information? It's not for entertainment purposes, that's for sure. So, you know, it's meant for healing and apply it. And I think, you know, I believe you should do work on yourself before you start working on anybody else. And I spent sure. years mm-hmm. and years on my own past life explorations.
From my own experience, and then we'll get right into the book. I found that I had about 8 regressions done on myself. I found that I was a male in most of them, and I was really mm-hmm. me. And I found that pretty interesting. And I also one time I got regressed by a really fantastic professional as to the most important past lives. And they were very telling. And some people from this life were in there, in my opinion, but in different incarnations, if you will. Does that all make sense?
Oh, that's exactly what it is. First of all, we pick one gender over the other about 75% of the time. So I've been predominantly female in my past lives. I mean, maybe you've been predominantly.
I was male, yeah.
Yeah.
Except for one.
Yeah. So I take remember. People back. I take people back to the life that's most impacting them right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've had so many past lives, but you're not working on karma from all of them. There's one in particular that you decided when you were planning this life that you were going to finally work on those issues. And so we bring people in and, you know, we do the whole identification part of it, and then we take them to the significant event that's impacting them right now. So we have them tell me their story. And then the questions are, you know, what do you have in common with who you were before? Do you recognize anybody from that life in your life now? Because, you know, we travel together as a soul family. So the same souls that are with us now have been with us from the beginning of time. We just change gender and we change roles lifetime after lifetime. So, but you could recognize them. You feel the essence of their soul somehow. You know, so I asked that question and yeah. And then why do you suppose spirit wanted you to see this life out of all of them? Because there's a lesson in it for you.
And your soul family does not necessarily mean your physical family, if you will.
Yeah, not at all. No.
Okay.
I mean, it's a combination. They could opt to come in as a member of your biological family if they choose to. But it's just like, you know, your mother in this life could have been your best friend in a previous right. life Got or it. Whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Let's move to the book, The Beatles, The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted a Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. You were a big fan when the Beatles first came out. Now tell us about the first time you saw the Beatles. Was it Ed Sullivan show, or how did you learn about the Beatles?
I had a friend in school who was crazy about the Beatles, and she had their first record and invited me over, and I listened to it with her, and she was so caught up in it that it got me all caught up in it too. And so when they came in February of 1960, February 7th, 1964, they landed in New York. I was looking, you know, I have my diary yet from that year, and I noticed that it took me a long time before I even wrote about them. And so I'm not really sure what the heck I was doing. I remember watching them on the Ed Sullivan show. And I remember that very, very shortly after that, I decided I was going to start a fan club for them, which I did.
Now, a good portion of the book, it's very interesting because there's about the spirituality in the Beatles, also about your experience as a fan club director and all the politics and everything that went into that. When you have a phenomena like the Beatles, which transcended just pop music, they were in everything. They were like more, they were more than what was laid out there. Tell us about your experience as running the fan club and some of the benefits, some of the things you learned about yourself from that you learned about the Beatles, and you learned about how a phenomena this big can get kind of stretched in different directions, not necessarily always in a good way.
Yeah. There's a difference between being a fan club president and a fan. I learned that the hard way. I mean, I was only in eighth grade, you know, when they came out. So I didn't have any of the tools yet that you get with maturity to know what I was getting myself into, because there was certainly a lot of diplomacy that I needed to learn that I didn't know. I mean, how do you deal with conflict? And certainly, you know, I was struggling in the beginning. You know, I did not we didn't have the internet. We didn't have, you know, I did my newsletters on my mother's Underwood typewriter, manual typewriter.
Sure.
So I was doing one at a time. I had no way to reproduce them. We had no database. That was a 3x5 card. That was my database. But I learned how to write better. I learned how to, you know, I started formatting newsletters. I was looking at magazines like, well, how do they do it? We didn't have any of those electronics tools. So, I mean, I would use a magic marker to draw my columns and stuff. You know, where do we get our news? We got our news from disc jockeys. We got our news from newspapers. And we got our news from the magazines that were coming out on the Beatles. So, you know, 16, Tiger Beat, a lot of those magazines that would come out. Some of them were devoted just to the Beatles, and we would take news from that. So one of the magazines would have a section on pen pals if you wanted to write to somebody. So I started writing to people, do you want to join my fan club? This was my first venture into marketing. Mm-hmm. So there were personal letters that were going out to all these people. So I took over my parents' basement and plastered all the walls with Beatles posters and stuff, and had my typewriter. So my entire teenage life was spent in the basement working on the newsletter and writing letters to people, eventually selling pictures. So the little entrepreneurial spirit kind of kicked in. I learned how to do that. I wasn't prepared for the hate mail or the factions that were, you know, like, especially when Yoko came in the picture and Linda McCartney came in the picture, you know, there are people that, you know, that as the Beatles started to sort of fall apart and you know, separate, you could see that the same thing was happening with the fans. So we were reflecting everything that they were doing, because we were like little sponges. Whatever they told us, you know, yeah, that's fine. That's great. You know, we did lose a lot of members along the way. Like, for instance, when John made his comment about Jesus being more popular, you know, that they were more popular than Jesus. We did lose a lot then. And, you know, then when, of course, when Yoko came in the picture, we lost a lot of people then. So this was going on in waves almost. It was like when they started taking drugs, you know, we put out there that Paul is taking LSD, lost a lot of fans then. So it was evolving. It was constantly evolving depending on what they were doing. So it makes sense that, you know, and at the same time, by the way, I was getting pressured by the fan club in New York, which was under Apple Records. They wanted all the independent fan clubs across the country to become part of their fan club. So they wanted all of our members to send them money to produce. And at the time, there was maybe 100 independent fan clubs across the country. And I fought them tooth and nail. I got a DJ in Chicago to help me out. And in the end, of course, you know, we didn't win. And we all became part of the official Beatles fan club. And I was named national chapter director. So I had all the fan clubs across the country sort of, I was the liaison between them and the people in New York. So there was all of this stuff going on. And I was maturing pretty quickly because there was no rules book. You know, there was nothing to tell you. What happens when you get a cease and desist order from a lawyer out in New York, you know, and you're a kid running a fan club. And you know, all that stuff. So it was, I do think I honed a lot of my skill set that I used later on. So those were really formative years for me.
So the Beatles went through a number of different stages, kind of similar to Miles Davis, who had like four or five different stages. The Beatles had their stages also. They were pop stars, and then they did kind of an acoustic thing, and then they started to make the move with the album Revolver into more of a little bit more expansive, if you will. And then they visited the Maharishi. They pulled some songs from that. They did the double album, the White Album. Just a lot of, they were groundbreakers in so many ways, and including blowing up, if you will, by in their prime. So Where did you first sense a seed of spirituality into what they were doing? Was it way back then? Or is it looking back now that you said these guys really were way more than just a pop group?
No, actually, you know, when they started to, when George got interested in the Maharishi and then convinced the other three that they should all go to India to study under him, a lot of us were like, what are you doing now? We didn't necessarily resonate. I know I personally did not resonate at all to that culture or the sound of that music when he, you know, George was learning the sitar from Ravi Shankar. And he started, you know, you'd start hearing that in the music. You know, if I don't know, I've read that George had a hard time getting his music onto an album because it was mostly John and Paul. But the thing about that was that if you could get past that, if the sound of the music wasn't something you resonated to, listen to the lyrics. And we didn't do that back then. I mean, it was like, you know, I didn't listen to the music, the lyrics that early on. But because George was so sincere in him doing this. And I understand, you know, they all learned how to do transcendental meditation. And if they took anything away from that experience, that was it, because I understand Paul still actually does meditate. But some of the music was deeply profound. Tomorrow Never Knows is like my favorite Beatles song. And that was taken from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, with some of those lyrics. So there were, and it was so deep and so profound, it just kind of got into your soul. And it made a difference. You know, it wasn't any of this surface kind of music that was, you know, la 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 kind of, and without thinking about anything. It started to get deeper and deeper and more profound. And if you really got into the lyrics, I guarantee you, it started to change your soul. I mean, I didn't know it back then that it was doing that. I didn't know that until much later, but I could see that's where it started for sure.
Okay, Joanne DiMaggio, my special guest, the new book, The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. So you got to see the Beatles twice in their, in kind of in their mop top years, if you will, at the very beginning. What was that experience like for you?
I got to see them in Chicago once at the White Sox ballpark and then at the International Amphitheater. And the interesting is that the White Sox ballpark was about a mile from where I lived. And I had tickets for the evening concert. And I could actually hear the screaming from the afternoon concert.
Wow.
The wind had just been, I don't know what. But anyway, it was so exciting. And then I went, and I was like, I was in total disbelief that that was actually them. I had seats up in the nosebleed section, so I was kind of far up in the grandstand. But the fact that they were that close to me physically, I was like rubbing my eyes. Is that really them? And I remember I was just crying more than I wasn't a screamer, you know, but I was just crying. And I realized later I was crying because I thought to myself, you are just as you're like everybody else here. You're not just because you have a fan club doesn't mean anything. Right. Just because you've been spending all this money on running this club and all this aggravation and all this time and energy doesn't give you any privileges whatsoever. You're just like people on either side. And I'm like, oh, yeah. But that was partially me because I never really pushed my agenda. I never really I never sent them a fan letter. I never sent them my newsletters. I really didn't want to meet them because I was too intimidated by them. So part of it was just me. But the interesting thing about those years is that you learn a lot about yourself, learn a lot about what makes you tick and what your motivations are. And so, so yeah, it was a huge learning experience. And I saw him again. And then I saw George and Ringo at the Bangladesh concert. So I got to see half of the group then. And that was just right about when the fan clubs were disbanded.
So. Do you think, Joanne, that the spirituality seeds were kind of fertilized, not only planted, but fertilized a little bit when they went to see the Maharishi? Because when you learn TM, I'm a TM practitioner, not for very long, but I do it twice a day. And it's really, it's I really get a lot out of it. That they started, in your words, kind of soul writing and being more and more prolific, and changes happened to each one of them. Obviously, George embraced it a little more than the others, but you could see how they were all four of them were impacted by it. Ringo is a TM practitioner. John was kind of a, you know, he went off, he kind of opened up after this with his relationship with Yoko, and then Paul just became as prolific as he was. I think he became even more prolific. So do you think that trip to India with all of the chaos that was around it in certain ways was a real igniter for their spiritual unfoldment?
Absolutely, because I don't know of anything else that was going on in their lives that would have pointed them in that direction. So, I mean, I think that they... there was a lot that they learned. I think it's like anything else. You take with you what it is that you can apply and the rest you let it go. So I know Ringo only lasted about 2 weeks on that trip. And Paul was not too far behind him. John and George hung in there a little bit longer. So it's not, doesn't surprise me. I mean, George was totally 100% devoted to that whole, to Eastern philosophies and did that, all that extensive reading and learning. He was just opening up to it. And I think it was a quote I put in my book. I think it was from Rabbi Shankar that, you know, didn't make any sense that with George's background that he would have any interest in this, unless, of course, he had, was reincarnated from a life in India, which, you know, yeah, that explains it, right? So, yeah, I think that definitely planted the seeds for them. And I think then, once the seed was planted, I think then they went off, you know, in their own direction and used it as it felt best for their particular lifestyle.
It seems like I think that was, they were there, I don't know, 67, 68, by 70, they kind of had gone in different directions. What do you think, Joanne, as a huge fan and somebody who's been very close to them throughout the years, what was the reason that they broke up?
Well, I think that you have four very strong personalities. It's not like some other groups that are out there. And other groups, I think you might have one really strong person in the group and the others are like, you know, just sort of doing their thing. And with the Beatles, it was like you had four individual artists who had who were growing at different stages. Mm-hmm. And I know for Paul, I've read so many quotes from him that he just wanted to work. And he just really wanted to be in the studio and to be producing. And he was sort of waiting, you know, like, when's John going to show up? Right. And John, of course, is with Yoko and they're doing their own thing. And I think that George had a backlog, certainly, of music that he had written that he couldn't get on Beatle albums. And so he wanted to do his own thing. So I think it was a matter of, you know, there was no way that they could find, I think Ringo would have gone along with them if they had stayed together, you know, but I think that they, that their own individual interests got the better of them. And I mean, I think it's a shame because of when you listen to Beatle music now and you listen to the sound of it, the four of them, their voices, how they interact with each other, you cannot duplicate that. So yeah, they can go off and do their own thing. Paul did his thing, John did his job. The sound is gone. It's not there anymore because you don't have the genius of all of those four souls working in conjunction with each other. They were part of a soul group. They had a soul contract, certainly. And from a reincarnation point of view, it's very easy to see, you know, how they came together and what their mission was. But, you know, if when you've got four very strong personalities, just takes one to say, I'm not doing this anymore. And then that's the end of it. So it's very, very sad. We held on as Beatle fans. We held on with hope that this wasn't permanent. You know, oh, let them get it out of their system and they'll come back. And of course, they never did. So so for us, and then of course, it split us, you know, and just as much as it split them. So so it was a very painful. Very painful.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Now, as a fan, also grew up kind of the same time period. I always thought that, you know, looking back now, like George Harrison, he didn't get that many songs on the albums. But if you think back, he was younger. He was really growing as an artist. And the songs, even the ones that they rejected, like All Things Must Pass, these are really great, great songs. Something, Here Comes the Sun. I mean, these are like two of the best Beatles songs of all time. And he had probably had to force them onto the albums because the other guys were so, you know, John and Paul were so strong, kind of, you know, blocking the way because maybe he was younger and all that. And he was a brilliant guitar player also, George Harrison. So unfortunately, I think that plus you had the, you know, Yoko and John were in love. That's great. Her being in the studio, I think, changed the dynamic when you have these four people who knew how to work together. And then you have somebody there sitting in that space. You don't know how that affects things. And that probably threw them off also. And then they were kind of growing with, you know, the pressures of fame and everything they did was under the microscope. And then they started to open up spiritually. That to me just like blew the whole thing up. And I guess that was their soul contract. My question, Joanne, is, do you think John Lennon's demise, his murder, was part of his soul contract?
You know what? I can't say that because of free will. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we come in with an agenda, but at any point in time, we can change it by changing our minds about something. so I don't really know. It could have been. I mean, I think he had some premonitions that his life was going to end early. None of us in our wildest dreams could have imagined it would end the way it did. Mm-hmm. And certainly once that happened, that was it. It was, you know, there was no way we could hold on to that dream that someday they would get together again. So yeah, it could very well have been, I don't know that for that.
Now, what was the trigger that the inciting incident, if you will, to inspire you to put a book together about the spiritual seeds of the Beatles, because they have impacted us. It's true. They were more than a pop group. They really, first of all, their music is timeless. mm-hmm. generations upon generations will listen to it because they're so cohesive. It's so, it feels like it's channeled almost. I mean, it's so brilliant. And I think it's better that they didn't let, you know, this, I love the Stones. I like to actually like the Stones better than the Beatles. And I admire them because of their longevity. And they still make good music. Their new album is actually very good. It's shockingly good. And it's a whole different dynamic, though. With the Beatles, it's almost, okay, let's put it in a capsule, and that's what it was, and that's what it is. And you cannot compete with that. That was just the greatest for that short period of time. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. As far as the spiritual seeds, for me, I always wondered, why did I choose a career in past life work? Because there was nothing in my life growing up that would have indicated that that's where I would show my, any interest. I was reading, like I said, I was reading books about reincarnation when I was maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, because growing up Catholic, I had lots of questions and no answers. So I thought, well, I'll just see what I can find out on my own. And I read A Search for Bridie Murphy and that came out in the mid-50s. And I read that book. And so I was really immersing myself in that genre. And then the Beatles came along and I let all that go. I didn't think about it anymore. And then the Beatles, they broke up. 72 was the end of everything. And then 15 years later, here comes Shirley MacLaine with Out on a Limb, the miniseries that was on 1987. And that was the big wake-up call for me. It was like, oh, she's talking about reincarnation. Oh, I used to be really passionate about that. So then I got involved with Edgar Casey's ARE, and I, you know, became a hypnotherapist and started to do research and all that. And I always said to myself, well, what, how in the world did I get here? How, you know, I lived on the south side of Chicago, and believe me, nobody talked about reincarnation. Right. And so, and growing up 12 years of Catholic school, you never, that word was never used, obviously.
Right, right.
So I thought, well, how in the world did I get from point A to point B? Then I started thinking, I wonder if it had anything to do with those 8 years I was totally immersed in the Beatle fan club. I dragged out all my newsletters, which I've kept from 1964 to 1972, the monthly newsletters I did in my fan club, and I started to read them. I thought, oh, maybe there'll be a hint here or there, you know, maybe a letter from another fan. We'll talk about this a little bit. So I was looking through my newsletters. I was looking through Beatle biographies of the different things that they were quoted. I was shocked that I had like 16 pages of quotes from them on reincarnation. I mean, I'm thinking, when did they say this? And wasn't I paying attention? And, you know, So that's what happened for me. It was like, then I came to the conclusion. And then I interviewed like 10 different other Beatle fans who are my age and asked them the same questions. You know, did the Beatles have any influence on your path of spirituality? And sure enough, yes, they did. Absolutely. So I thought it was pretty fascinating that that we didn't realize it was happening at the time it was happening, which is why I say they were planting a seed, and the seed did not blossom until maybe 20 years later. So I found it really fascinating to tie it together like that, that it, then suddenly it made perfect sense. You know, yeah, this is why I'm doing this. Yeah.
Last question, the Bangladesh concert. Tell us a little bit about that, because that was a significant event. It was one of those first benefit concerts ever. It was huge. You had George Harrison, Ringo, Ravi Shankar. You had Eric Clapton, I believe. I don't know if Bob Dylan was there or who else, but.
For me, it was a very kind of bittersweet experience because we were told as presidents of fan clubs that we were going to get tickets, that Apple was going to allow us to, not they weren't going to give us the tickets, we had to buy them, but we were all going to at least have really wonderful seats and sit together as a group. And many of us went to New York without having a ticket, thinking that a ticket was going to be waiting for us. And when we got there, there were no tickets for us. Luckily for me, I had friends in New York who had the foresight to go out and get tickets, so I was able to still go to the concert. But it was a very upsetting kind of situation. It was also the first time that I actually stood in front of a hotel, the Park Lane Hotel. It's where George and Ringo were staying. And I had never experienced that as a groupie before, right? So that was one of the most humiliating experiences of my life, to be standing there like that. And I really wanted to give up the fan club at that point. The whole thing just seemed... I was in college at that point, and it was like my father was like, "You're too old to be doing this. Give this up." But when I went to the concert, that changed my mind because I realized how much I loved George mm-hmm. and how much I loved Ringo, and how much I was grateful to be a part of that whole experience. I didn't realize it then, but it really was one of the very first fundraiser kind of concerts that are coming, right? Mm-hmm. We heard so many stories about why John wasn't there and why Paul wasn't there. And, we got to talk to Mal Evans and some of the other people in the entourage. And so it was fitting that it was the last thing that I did really Beatle-like after that. With a short amount of time after, within months, the whole thing fell apart. The clubs mm-hmm. were gone. So.
Amazing.
So I'm glad that I was a part of it when, I had that opportunity.
Such a great experience and a wonderful story. You picked such interesting topics for your books. The name of this one, The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. Special guest on Guys Guys Radio, return guest Joanne DiMaggio. Tell everybody where they can find your book and where they can find more about you and the work that you do.
Please come to my website, joannedimaggio.com, joannedimaggio. And all of my services are on there. I've got a blog, and there's just plenty of info. There's a Q&A section. So if you're interested in having a regression or learning soul writing, you could book it right online. And then all the books that I've written are showcased there as well. So, and you can email me too if you'd like, joannedimaggio.com. I'm happy to answer any and all emails, and I'm happy to send out that soul writing handout if you're interested in it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming back to Guys Guys Radio. Much success with the book, and keep doing what you're doing, Joanne.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, a terrific conversation with our guest, Joanne DiMaggio. I love the work Joanne does with the soul writing, which is different, as Joanne explained, than automatic writing. And if you're going to get involved with that stuff, as she mentioned, you want to ground yourself and have some protection, because you're going to let things start to come in that you want to record, but you want to be able to protect yourself and protect your energy. She also does a past life research and therapy, so she's actually regressed herself. I am a certified advanced clinical master hypnotist, and I don't even regress myself. I've been regressed, and I've regressed other people, but wow, that's something. And today we talked about the Beatles, and the Beatles planting the spiritual seed in our souls, and we covered that experience that they had and all their different kind of periods they went through, from the chirpy stuff they did at the beginning with She Loves You. Everybody was so enchanted with their work. And then they got into some more folky type stuff with Rubber Soul, a great album, my favorite album. I think it's George's favorite album also. And then they broke through with Revolver, which started to really shatter the template that they had built. And then they got into Sgt. Pepper's and the White Album, and then finally Let It Be and Abbey Road. And what a masterpiece Abbey Road Side 2 is at the very end of their career. And actually, Let It Be came out after Abbey Road, but Abbey Road, I believe, was the last album they recorded together before they went off on their solo careers. So thank you, Beatles. And they did plant spiritual seeds in our soul, I think, because their influence is positive. All you need is love. and so many other great songs like that. And they also really were so finely tuned together as a group. It's almost like they were ethereal. They were channeling the music together. And the sum of their parts, as we've learned over the years, has been so much stronger than, I think, than most of their solo work, with the exception, I'd say, George Harrison's All Things Must Pass. That's an incredible 3LP set. McCartney's done a number of great things over the years. Ringo's had a couple of great things he's done. And John Lennon, I think, when he did Imagine, maybe one of the greatest songs of all time. So they've done a lot on their own, but let's face it, together, they were pretty much unmatched and untouchable in terms of songwriting and the influence they had on our culture. And I think people will be listening to Beatles music forever, basically, because they're that good and they're that charming and they're that fun and they have so much energy in their work. So, Guys Guys Radio, we're here every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio in Southern California, 106.5 FM, 1050 AM. The show rebroadcasts on Saturday at 8 p.m. Pacific Time, Sunday at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. We're also available on their app and any other way you can access KCAA Radio. On Thursdays, the YouTube, the Rumble, and the podcast drop. The podcast available on all major platforms worldwide. YouTube and Rumble, you can watch the interviews. You can watch my interview with and conversation with Joanne. And also, we're on UK Health Radio all weekend long, four times per weekend on demand, and we're featured on their new podcast. So you can really catch us anywhere. I also write a column for UK Health Radio's digital magazine. It's called Health Triangle Magazine, and my column is called Aging is a Choice. It explodes the myth about what we've been told about aging, and I share a lot of practices that I have done and continue to do to keep myself as young and vital as possible. I share those with you. You can also catch them on my website, robertmanni.com, as well as over 300 blog posts about life, love, the pursuit of happiness. It's all there for you. It's free right now. And you can download three free chapters to my novel, The Guy's Guy's Guide to Love, which is the source material for everything Guy's Guy. And it's a sexy romp through the fast-moving, high-stake world of Madison Avenue advertising, and it's been deemed the man's successor to Sex and the City. So three free chapters, and then you can pick up a physical or digital copy. And we've got a lot of information for you. We've got a lot of content for you. We've got a lot of great guests coming up. I'm so appreciative to all of my guests that I've interviewed and had connected with over the years, over 700 thought leaders, my wonderful producer, Chris, my strategy lead, Ryan, and most of all, I am so appreciative of you, our growing audience. It just keeps growing and growing, and we have more and more platforms. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm going to see you again next week, as always. And until then, like I always say, guys, guys, finish first.